Secret World Chronicle, a podcast series created by Mercedes Lackey and Steve Libby. Ski and Do, written by Mercedes Lackey, read by Veronica Jaguar. Not for the first time, Roddy McSkeen wished he hadn't been born a bloody metahuman. It wasn't that he was unhappy with being dragooned into MI6. The good gods knew that every man Jack and plenty of woman Jills were needed in this war. The bloody damned Nazis had run over everything in their path and had eaten most of France by now. About the time they took all of the Netherlands, they had started bombing the hell out of London. And not just the damn Luftwaffe, but the Luftwaffe Übermenschen too. The superior men, like Eisenfaust and his squad. Blitzkrieg, they called it, and it looked like a lightning storm every night. Not that Roddy had seen it when it first started, no. He'd been where the old woman said he belonged, right on the farm, tending the shaggy, sleepy-eyed cattle, like his father, and his father's father, and so on back to the first of his line to hold that particular piece of Highland land. Not that he wouldn't have volunteered if the old woman hadn't strictly forbade it, on account of his being the only male left in the clan. The oddly named clan, Son of the Knife. But even so, they wouldn't have taken him. Not on account of being the only male left of his clan, but on account of his size. He knew jockeys that were taller than he was. The old woman said it was the Pharisee blood in him. Once he'd gotten his marching orders, the learned fellows at MI6 looked interested and said it might as well be he was almost pure Pictish. Whatever the case was, it was a fact that Roddy topped out at 4 feet tall, and they didn't make uniforms in his size, nor boots, nor rifles that weren't taller than he was. So when the whole bleeding war started, and the Nazis began wrapping up other countries and taking them home, and the Tommies started joining the frogs at the border of the Lorraine, well, the old woman wanted him to stay. He saw no reason not to. The army had no bleeding use for him. That was true through the months and weeks that followed, right up to the point where three things happened. The Blitz began, and Spitfire, and then the rest of Wing Alpha, suddenly proved that the Nazis weren't the only ones that could spawn what the authorities decided primly to call metahumans. The Yanks didn't sit around on their hands the way some people had predicted, as newsreel footage of the Übermenschen in action was enough to even convince a pacifist that the Germans weren't going to stop at the Channel. And he, Roderick McSkeen, woke up to find himself in a bed that was not his own. The lady already in the bed, Deirdre of the grass-green eyes and flaming hair, of the tiny foot and the winsome smile, of the breasts of a goddess and skin like newly skimmed cream, who he had in fact been dreaming about before he woke up, was not anyone he'd have had a ghost of a chance with. She proved it by screaming her fiery head off. And Roddy, panicked, did something, and found himself back in his own bedroom, though he missed his bed by about a foot, and landed on his arse on the cold stone floor. It was the bruising that convinced him he couldn't have been dreaming. Now, even the old woman would admit that Roddy had a knack for thinking quickly, especially when things went badly wrong, and the first thing that flashed into his head was that he'd better be able to prove he was in his cottage and not in Deirdre McFarlane's bed 10 miles away, which meant he'd better get himself one or more sober witnesses to this at some point in the next 5 minutes. He pulled on a pair of pants with naught on beneath, because he slept with naught on, shoved his feet into his boots, and ran out into the street. "Did you hear that?" he shouted to his neighbor, who was just feeding his hutch of rabbits, doing his best to look wild-eyed. "Roddy, you wee bastard, I hear it now!" the neighbor laughed. "You've been dreaming again." Then the neighbor sobered, for it was known that the old blood was thick in the McSkeen family, and although the old woman swore that not a bit of the magic had made its way into him, there was always the chance it was late in coming. The neighbor knew this, because it was his wife that stood for the East in the old woman's monthly gathers. It wasn't that sort of dream now. Roddy shook his head, rubbed the back of his neck, and looked sheepish. "Ach, nay," he said, and forbore to say what kind of a dream it was. Now, Deirdre McFarland was a canny lass, and before she went accusing a man of being where no man should have been at 6 a.m, and especially not a man she did not know and did not care to know, she made certain inquiries in that man's neighborhood. And, being not wanting to be made a fool of, when she found witnesses that he'd been standing in his own back garden at 6:01, she kept her mouth tight shut. And being no fool, and a month later sober reflection on Roddy's ability to keep his own mouth shut, and a good memory telling her that not everything about Roddy McSkeen was less than a proper man's size, when a general, no less, came up and took him up by special draft, Miss Deirdre McFarland gave him a proper patriotic farewell, which bid fair to match that dream. And even at this moment his ability to be 10 miles, or more, away in seconds was known only to her, him, and MI6. By the time the general came for him, the village and most of the district knew of his other talent, for it had manifested in front of most of them. Roddy could turn invisible. He'd done it in full view, when a host of young people, in the middle of market day, when he was in the public house, when he was supposed to be making rabbit hutches for the old woman. Now, the way that came about was this. The old woman was as tight-fisted as any 6 Scots put together, which is saying a fair bit, and the wood and nails she had given Roddy to build those hutches with were all scavenged from every scrap of an abandoned structure that the old woman's sturdy boots could carry her to. Before he could even use the nails, he had to straighten them, and after banged his fingers and thumbs to flinders doing so, he reckoned he needed a dram or two or three to take the ache out. As to why the old woman wanted rabbit hutches, well, she and every other person in the village remembered the Great War and all the meat going to the soldiers, as well it should. There was rationing, and it was understood that something had to be done. There was war again, and the young men marching off, and there was no doubt the little fellow that looked like Charlie Chaplin and sounded like a madman needed to be put down. Even the old woman, though she would not let Roddy go, said that Hitler was doing some wicked bad things and needed to be put down. But it was a hard thing to be sending the cattle off and getting no meat for yourself. Ah, but there were plenty alive who remembered the last dust-up, and remembered rabbits now. The last time the rabbits had been poached, mostly, but you needed a more reliable system than poaching, for a war that looked as black as the inside of a widow's hat. The last time, no one had been making tinned rabbit, and the chances of rabbit rationing were pretty slim. So hutches were being put up all over the village, and rabbits, after all, could be fed on hay that was easily come by in the country. So the old woman was to have her hutches too, and no shilly-shallying about the work, for all she had given him shite to build with. And just as he was lifting his second dram to his lips, when he heard someone at the window of the pub exclaim, "Ach, 'tis the old woman a-coming this way!" And the men that had been standing shoulder to shoulder with him at the bar cursed and looked through him. No more did the old woman see him when she poked her head in through the door. When he went visible again, there was a great old to-do. The old woman boxed his ears and checked him for magic and still found none, and he wasn't at all surprised when the general turned up looking for him. Likely so, and rightly done. With talents like his, there was a lot even a little fellow could do. By then, of course, the old woman had cast his weird, and had summoned him, and had looked at him in the way that made him go hot and cold together, and told him soberly that though he hadn't a smidge of the old magic in him, he had something else, and he had best go to use it for to save a great many lives. So that was why he was in a tiny little fisherman's shack on the English Channel, one among hundreds, maybe thousands even, of more little boats and not-so-tiny boats and great huge troop ships and all manner of craft, all rushing towards a place called Dunkirk. They were going to evacuate troops off the beaches, the troops of the Allies that had been trapped there by German troops and a tank division, and 3 Übermenschen, Panzer Wolf, Panzer Low, and Panzer Tiger. He was going to save, if he could, the pride of the USA, the first 2 metahumans to come from the United States to fight at the side of the British and the French, Dixie Belle and Yankee Doodle. And here he was, one lone little man, crouched in the bottom of one lone little boat, trying not to be sick, with the weight of the Alliance on his back and the blessing of the old woman on his head. Not young Roddy anymore. Now he was something else entirely. He was, by fiat of MI6, Skiendu, the little black knife, the last, hidden, and most desperate of the weapons of a Scot. In the chaos that was the evacuation of the Allied forces from the beachheads up and down the coast of France on either side of the seacoast town of Dunkirk, it was easy for one small man, going the wrong way, to make himself lost without ever going invisible. In fact, going invisible was probably ill-advised. He'd have been trampled. It was unbelievable, probably horrible, and Roddy was right glad that darkness hid most of it from him. The fear was so thick you could cut it. The smell of cordite and smoke mingled with the smell of blood and death and the smell of the sea. The men crowded onto the beaches were in despair, seeking escape from the meat grinder that was the Nazi Blitzkrieg, and yet fearing they would be cut down before reaching safety. The noise was incredible. The beaches were being shelled, and the edges of the evacuation harried by Nazi stormtroopers. If there was a hell on earth, this was it. And yet, it was not as bad as it could have been, and he knew why. The tank division had halted far short of here. The commanders on the ground expected it to arrive at any moment, and were harrying their men into the hundreds of tiny, shallow-drafted boats coming right up to the sand that would take the evacuees out to the larger ships. It was not going to come. In fact, it would not arrive until the beaches were deserted, and every last man that could got off had been. That was the old woman's doing, her and her gathering, and gatherings and moots and meets wherever they had been alerted as to the need for a great work tonight. Roddy was entirely vague as to what they were doing, but he had no question as to how it was being done. Magic. Magic that ran in Roddy's ancestry, but that he did not share. Not that he was terribly unhappy about this. There were all manner of rules about using magic, and he was pretty sure he would run afoul of them. And the wizards and witches and sorcerers and what all generally seemed to always be having some sort of quarrel with each other, which made it all the more rare that they could ever get together long enough for a great work, like chasing off the Spanish Armada or stopping a German panzer division. But the men here didn't know that it was happening, and wouldn't believe him if he told them, so they were vibrating between panic and apathy, though they tried to show neither. And Roddy couldn't blame them, seeing he was steadily making his way towards the enemy lines, rather than away. In an hour he had cleared the jam up. That was when he went invisible. Immediately he felt a rush of relief. Every moment since he'd waded ashore, he'd felt terrified. It had all sounded so simple back in that briefing room. Get onto the beach, under cover of the evacuation, ghost his way to his contact, find out where Dixie Belle and Yankee Doodle were being held, free them, or, more likely, help them to free themselves. They were infinitely more powerful than he was. Both of them could fly without needing an airplane. Yankee Doodle shot some sort of energy blast from his eyes, and Dixie Belle was unbelievably strong. He'd seen footage of Belle punching holes in airplanes and picking up cars. Freeing them seemed almost trivial. Two people like that, probably all he had to do was go invisible, meet his contact, go invisibly to wherever they were being kept, unlock a door or such, and they would do the rest. But of course he hadn't been able to take on his invisibility, and he had felt as if there were a target painted on his back the whole time he had been scrambling through that mess. Short as he was, he stood out as something unusual, and the Nazis knew the Alliance had its own metahumans now. And why would there be someone as short as he was on that beach unless he had something to make up for what he lacked in size? But now, in the safety of a copse of shattered trees, he faded into nothingness and drew a deep, relieved breath. Now he had to only get through the enemy lines and find his contact. From here on it should be smooth sailing. Roddy was coming to the conclusion that nothing was ever as simple as it seemed. He had found his contact easily enough, and the first complication set in right there. His contact was a woman, a girl, really, and one who carried a rifle on her back as casually as Deirdre McFarland carried a tennis racket. They huddled just outside the high brick wall, with broken glass or some other nastiness atop it, no doubt, where she said Belle and Yank were being kept. "It is some sort of laboratory," she had explained. "It was so before the Boche came and they took it over. So you proof yourself within, mon ami, freeze them, and..."
"That doesn't work no way, lassie," he whispered apologetically. "I cannot go where I haven't been before, or at least," he amended hastily, "where I know someone that's there."
He flushed, thinking of Miss Deirdre. The old woman would have been scandalized to know how little she slept in.
"Nom de nom, sacre merde!"
The young woman swore vehemently under her breath.
"You can at least proof out again, no?"
He thought about that and flushed again.
"I didn't think so," he admitted. "I cannot see where we are, you can, it being dark and all. I mean, I could likely go home, but not out here. It'll have to be the hard way."
The woman tossed her head and unslung her rifle.
"It is not to be helped, then," she said with resignation. "I will, too, remain here. Someone must report if you do not succeed."
For a moment he felt a surge of resentment, but in the next moment he realized she was right.
"Right," he said with resignation. "I'm off."
He might be invisible, but that did not mean he was undetectable. Dogs would smell him, for instance. He could leave footprints. People could bump into him and he could bump into things. In fact, he had to be twice as careful in tight quarters, as he couldn't see where his feet and arms were. So the first step was to get past the dogs. Prowling carefully about downwind told him that there were two with their handlers at the gate, and at least two more patrolling the area between the walls and the building. He considered this carefully. He couldn't slip past the ones at the gate. There wasn't enough room between them, and they surely would smell him. He could go over the wall, perhaps, but then he would still have to contend with dogs and handlers inside. On the other hand, he looked up at the top of the wall. If he could get up there, and didn't get slashed up on whatever was up there. He prowled around the outside until he found a section in shadow. The wall itself was no challenge for a lad who had been scampering about the Highlands most of his life. It was the glass and added razor wire atop it that made a challenge, and if he got too cut up, he'd bleed, and a trail of blood was not invisible. Finally, he balanced precariously atop the support and peered at the roof of the building itself. This was going to be very tricky, because he couldn't teleport himself and stay invisible at the same time.
"Oh, let there be no lads with sharp eyes at those windows."
He waited until the dog and handler were out of sight, waited until everything seemed quiet, fixed his eyes on a shadowed nook where the chimney met the slippery slate roof, took a deep breath, and found himself sliding momentarily down the slates until he lodged against the chimney, cast frantically about himself to make sure he hadn't been seen, made the little twist of his mind that made him invisible again, and clung to the tiles and tried to catch his breath. No turning back now. It took careful climbing and hunting, spread-eagled on the roof pitch, to find the entrance to the roof that he knew must be there. A building like this one, with over a dozen chimney pots and three or four times as many fireplaces, would have needed the attentions of a chimney sweep regularly, and people who put walls with glass atop them around their buildings did not want sweeps leaning ladders against their walls, so there had to be roof access. By now, of course, the fireplaces were disused and probably boarded up, but the roof access was still there. He paused and listened with every fiber, but heard nothing. Cautiously, he tried the hatch. It was locked, but he could tell it was a simple slip catch. A bit of knife work, and it wasn't locked anymore. It opened up on complete blackness. There was no way of telling if the attic was clear or crammed with rubbish, or full of snoring soldiers. Well, maybe not the latter, not unless they could sleep without breathing. He glanced up. He didn't dare risk a match, not with the air above him full of the drone of planes. Breathing a prayer, he lowered himself down until he was hanging on by his fingertips.
then let go.
It was just about a 4-foot drop. He hit as softly as he could and remained crouched in place, frozen, listening. Had anyone heard him? Was anyone coming? Nothing. Feeling his way inch by inch, he moved away from the open hatch and took a chance with a match. Except for some crates piled up in half the attic, the low-ceilinged room was empty. There was another hatch on the floor. He let the match burn down almost to his fingertips, memorizing the room, then blew it out. Once again he listened with everything he had at the hatch, and heard nothing. If luck was with him, this building, now labs, had once been a stately old home, and this hatch gave out into the little rooms that had once been the servants' quarters, provided they hadn't been gutted to make more lab space. He raised the hatch open a hair. There was light, but it was dim, and seemed to come from some distant point. There was no one he could see immediately. He raised it a little more and took a better look. It looked like the hall of servants' quarters. They were probably used for storage, being more convenient than the attic. Moving as quickly as he could and still be quiet, he slid through the hatch and let it down. Again, he sighed. Now he was safer. The soldiers would notice doors and hatches opening and shutting, but they could not see him, and the dogs were all outside. Halfway down the hallway, he heard the tramp of boots on stairs and the sounds of voices speaking what he assumed was German. For a moment, he froze, then slipped quickly to the end of the hall and the blackout windows there. He squeezed himself in next to it as 4 soldiers, smelling slightly of wine and sausages, clumped their way past him and separated, 2 to a room. So the guards on duty here were using these rooms as their quarters. So much for using the roof as an escape route if he was spotted and pursued. Pressing his back to the wall, he inched his way down the stairs to the 2nd floor. This one was lit, much better, and he realized now that he had another problem. He didn't know where, exactly, Bell and Yank were being held, which essentially meant that he was going to have to check every room. Wouldn't he? It was a big building. Why, there must be 20 rooms on this floor alone. His moment of hesitation was cut through by the sound of a child screaming. The sound sent a rush of electricity fueled by fury across his nerves. As the child continued to cry out, screams fading into a pitiful whimpering that was worse than the screams, he raced down the hallway, following his ears, and he was just about to break down the door that the cries led him to when his good senses kicked in, and instead of crashing through it, he placed his hand on the knob and opened it just a crack, just enough to see inside. He saw the back of someone dressed in a surgeon's gown, as pristine and white as bleach and scrubbing could make such a garment. The man leaned over something, or someone, utterly preoccupied, muttering to himself. Silently, Roddy slipped inside, closing and locking the door behind him. At this point, the contents of the room were in full view. There were 4 beds here, if you could call something with straps and harnesses like a torture device a bed. Only one was occupied, by a frail-looking girl who could not have been more than 13 or 14 years old, dark-skinned, black-haired. Without thinking twice about it, Roddy knew what she was. A gypsy. The man turned away from the little table he had been fussing with, and back to the girl strapped down to the bed. There was a wicked sharp scalpel in his hand, and at the sight of it the girl's whimpers turned to screams again. Less than a second later, the man was on the floor, with his own scalpel sticking out of his eye. He was quite dead. Roddy was no stranger to killing, although this was the first human being he had killed. Then again, anyone that would do what that man had been doing to that poor little girl. Her body was a mass of scars, healing wounds and fresh ones. Even as he fought with the straps to get her undone, one of the fresh wounds began to heal before his eyes. It was pretty clear what had been happening here. The gypsy was a metahuman too, one that could heal herself, and this butcher had been cutting on her, trying to find out how she was doing it.
Now she watched him silently, looking remarkably calm for someone who had just been rescued from torture by a man who had been invisible. But when he got her right hand free, the first thing she did was to reach for him and rest her fingers lightly on his forehead. He froze as a picture formed in his mind, which pretty much confirmed what he had guessed. The old woman had quite a bit to do with the Romani, as they like to call themselves. There was a lot of magic in some of their bloodlines, and when one magician entered the territory of another, it was only polite to come calling, unless he planned on open warfare. And no one in his right mind would go to war against the old woman. So he knew a bit of lingo, and he struggled to make himself plain. "Didn't come to fetch you, but I'll get you out anyway, lass." Her eyes widened and filled with tears, and another picture came into his mind. It fair made him sick to his stomach and infused him with an energy he hadn't known he had. Fired by it, he gathered the girl in his arms and landed heavily on the painfully clean stone floor of the old woman's cottage. As he knew she would be, the old woman and her gathering were convened in their circle, one small cog in the great work going on that was keeping the worst of the German menace from falling on the heads of the evacuation at Dunkirk. And because they were only one small cog, it did no harm for the old woman to rise from her place and take the fainting girl out of Roddy's arms.
"Her people be dead, I got no time. Take care of her," he said, the first time he had ever issued an order to the old woman. He barely had time to register her nod before he gathered himself again and landed back on the corridor, outside the door to the room of horror. He made himself invisible again, then knelt where he had landed, exhausted and unable to move. That was the longest that he had ever jumped before. He wasn't sure he could ever do it again. Fortunately, it seemed that the sick bastard that had been torturing the girl was not exactly popular with the rest of his lot. The rest of the floor was empty, and there was not even so much as a single soldier guarding the area. Roddy was left undisturbed while he waited for the weakness to pass. And it was while he was kneeling there, with his head down, that he realized, no, he was not going to have to hunt through every room in the building to find the American metahumans. He was only going to have to look for the room with all the guards in it. The room with all the guards on it was on the ground floor, and whatever its purpose had been when this was a house, it had been heavily reinforced with a bank-like vault door. The purpose of such a thing puzzled Roddy for a moment, as did the symbol on a sign beside the door, small red dot with 5 red lightning bolts radiating outwards from it. Whatever it was that the former owners of this place thought needed such protection, it must have been dangerous. But not nearly as dangerous, at least not to the Nazis, as what was in there now, judging by all the guards. But the Germans were nothing if not precise, and that very precision made it possible for Roddy, moving slowly and carefully, to ease his way past them and into the room beyond, just in time to hear a resonant voice say, in heavily accented English, "I think there's no more need for a mask to hide behind, little white dove."
"Gott in Himmel! Just mein in Schwarz!"
He jumped back, giving Roddy a clear view of the female captive, her arms and legs encased in what looked like layer upon layer of anchor chains.
"Watch who you're calling what, you Ku Klux Klan reject,"
spat Dixie Bell, her dark, handsome face contorted with contempt as she looked up into the chiseled features of Eisenfaust. Roddy recognized both of them from photographs, although he was probably the only person outside of the select circle of enlisted metahumans that knew Dixie Bell was not, in fact, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl on the American recruitment posters. Then again, the ongoing romance she had with Yankee Doodle, assuming there really was a romance and not that it too was a complete fabrication, was illegal in several states. Or so this had been explained to him as the reason why the rescue had to be kept secret.
"Dieses ist unmöglich,"
the German muttered, the back of his neck going red. Then he straightened. I was going to offer you the opportunity to join us, he said, his voice so cold as to freeze the very air in the room. But,
oh, I don't fit in with your master race, Belle replied, the sweet sarcasm in her voice as palpable as the ice.
I guess you don't, sugar, said a second voice. Not that we would have accepted, of course. Beer gives me gas, and that tin pot despot of yours gives me worse gas.
Eisenfaust pulled back and slapped Yank with the back of his hand so hard that the crack sounded like a gunshot. Bell screamed an obscenity, and Eisenfaust raised his hand to slap her too, then thought better of it.
I will not contaminate my flesh with touching you, he said contemptuously. Contemplate your fates. Then ere Dr. Erbsen is finished with his subject upstairs, he will come to study you. Most of his subjects have not lived too long. Perhaps you will be the exception.
With that, Eisenfaust turned abruptly and marched out the door, which swung ponderously shut behind him. Now Roddy could see that, like Belle, Yankee Doodle was tied hand and foot to a chair that had been bolted to the floor. But the top half of his head was encased in a kind of helmet with an opaque visor. That visor, Roddy realized immediately, must be mirrored on the inside, so that anything Yank tried would just get shot back into his own face. But the important thing was not what their captors had intended to do with them. The important thing was that he and the prisoners had the entire room to themselves. He allowed himself to become visible. Belle reacted with a startled, smothered squeak.
Marie? Baby?
Yank reacted with alarm, turning his head blindly from side to side.
What is it? What?
'Tis all right, laddie,
Roddy assured him as he stepped forward to take the helmet from Yank's head.
I'm Ski Indu of MI6, and I'm here to help.
With a little puff of displaced air, the Scotsman landed beside his French resistance guide, falling wearily to the ground as he bit back a scream that turned only into a swift intake of breath.
Sacrament! She whispered harshly. Do not! What happened? Were they not there? Could you not freeze them? What?
Roddy tiredly held up one hand for silence, forgetting in the dark she couldn't see it. But it hardly mattered, as in the next moment, the old stone mansion literally erupted with the sound of the pride of the U.S. metahuman forces, began the grimly joyful task of kicking and blasting their way out of imprisonment. Holes began to appear in the slate roof, as Yankee Doodle's energy blasts reached for the heavens. Under the cover of the ruckus, Roddy and his contact slipped away. He looked back only once, just in time to see the two figures, illuminated by the flames licking up from the ravaged building beneath them, shooting off into the sky. Roddy smiled. The old woman couldn't have done it better herself.